in the night time when I, you know, when I'm there by myself, I often say, you know, is it worth it? You know, going through it, and would I be better off dead? And then I think about it for a while and I say, well, I'd be no good to anybody if I was dead. And it's mostly the loneliness now, you know, that I get depressed over.
I didn't care two hoots whether I was dead or not. I was just that fed up with everything. I'm so depressed over in a matter of 9 weeks. I was suffering really bad depression that I just didn't care. You know, I really thought that the aspirin would have done it. I mean, 100, you know, but they didn't, like, you know. But I suppose now I often do. I'm not saying I don't get depressed anymore. I do. I do get terrible bouts of depression. But I don't think it's as bad since I left home.
To be or not to be? The question that plagued Hamlet's mind is obviously still bothering people. And recent reported figures say that over 170 people in the 26 counties went so far as to actually kill themselves last year. Now, why would people do that? What makes some people attempt it? Are they any different from the rest of us? These are some of the questions we hope to answer with the help of Dr. Dermot Walsh, consultant psychiatrist to the Medico-Social Research Board, and Professor J.N.P. Moore, consultant psychiatrist to St. Patrick's Hospital, Dublin. First, Dr. Walsh.
There are differences between the types of people who attempt suicide on the one hand and who actually kill themselves on the other. Very briefly, young people, and in particular women, attempt suicide, whereas those who kill themselves are more likely to be male and elderly.
Is that because the males are stronger, that they feel they can go through with it, whereas a female might balk at the last minute?
Yep, this may be it. Males, for instance, use violence as a means of killing themselves more often than females, and quite obviously males are better able to shoot themselves or hang themselves or stab themselves than women, and that certainly may be one factor.
Now, the ordinary person in the street who was going about in a normal fashion, quite happy, could it happen to him or her one day that they would suddenly feel like committing suicide and go ahead with it?
Yes, I think it can happen to anyone. I don't think anyone is immune. Obviously, your happy man in the street may not always be a happy man in the street. He may become a depressed man living alone with a lot of deprivation, social deprivation, economic deprivation, and so on at some other point in time. And that, of course, may very, very easily change his outlook on life, lead to depression, and if the depression is severe enough, to suicide.
Well, does suicide normally come after depression? Would there have been a depression period there first for a while?
Yeah, people who are depressed constitute the greatest single risk for suicide. Because obviously, if you are depressed, your perception of reality in relation to the present, the past, and most importantly of all, to the future, changes and becomes gloomy and negative. And in that frame of mind, you are more likely to feel that the future isn't worth the candle, and therefore to leave this life by your own hand.
But is there something built in some people that is triggered off by some emotional crisis? I mean, would some people be more prone than others? Would there be a family history there?
Of depression, perhaps, but not of suicide per se. I think one sees suicide as the end result of these depressive illnesses that we've been speaking about. And it is true that certain forms of depression do have a hereditary on genetic basis, though they are perhaps in the minority. Other depressions come from unfavourable environmental circumstances. Things have gone wrong, as so many things can go wrong in one's life. And because of that, one feels thoroughly fed up, depressed, can't see any way out, and takes an overdose and kills oneself.
He found out he was going out and he was drinking very, very heavy. And I was left in the house on my own a lot with the children. And then it was when he'd come home, you know, I used to sit and brood what happened, what he'd do to me, and what he'd, you know, he'd call me violent names and really hurt me. And I just felt on several occasions, I didn't want to live. You know, I really wanted to take something. I was on very strong tablets at this stage, but I think my head was a little bit screwed on because I didn't take these heavy tablets. But this particular day, then, you know, he was out drinking, we had to be in fighting, and he was saying, wait till I come back, I'm packing my clothes and I'll finish you off, you know. And I decided then I bought a box of aspirin and took them all. As I said, you know, nothing happened in the way of killing me, but they made me very, you know, very sick and headaches. But I didn't, like, do anything to upset him. He went out the next morning drinking and just left me there to cope with the children.
At that time, did you really intend doing away with yourself?
Yes, I did, because I left a letter. You know, I left a very important letter, like, saying why I was doing it and explaining that, you know, I didn't do it because I was insane. I just did it because I was so depressed. You know, when he'd go out on these drinking boots and leave me, and then when he'd come back, what I had to face, you know, for nothing at all, because I didn't go out drinking.
But if you had stronger tablets at the time, would you have taken them?
I'd say I would have, yeah. I probably would have. You know, thank God now I hadn't, but I think I would have.
Professor J.N.P. Moore has been a psychiatrist in St. Patrick's Hospital, Dublin, for many years and has dealt with all kinds of depressive illness.
I would say that in general, people commit suicide because they feel life is not worth living. Those people, that kind of emotion is determined by the fact that they are depressed. So that most successful suicides, except times of political crisis or something of the kind, in ordinary life, successful suicide is a complication of a depressive illness. And people quite unreasonably feel there's no future for them. Even people who were economically quite well off, in apparently good health, with things going well for them, get a feeling of sadness and gloom and despondency, and they can't react to good news even by feeling happy. They feel dead inside, so that it may seem a logical thing for them to kill themselves. They feel the world would be better without them, and that they themselves would be out of the pain in which they're in. Because it's very important to remember that depression is real pain. And I've been told many thousands of times, doctor, I'd rather suffer any pain than go through that depression again. And it is the pain of depression, the intolerable pain, that makes people wish to end their lives. So that you may say, is there any special kind of person? I think, first of all, everybody gets depressed at times. It's important to realize that depression is a normal reaction to loss or failure or disappointment or bereavement, any of the slings and arrows which all of us have to meet in a lifetime. It's only if it goes on too long or becomes excessive that we think of it in terms of an illness. And some people are more prone to it than others for two kinds of reasons. Some are more prone because in their general reactions to stress, they are not too robust. They're very sensitive and easily upset, and not perhaps as mature as other people, so that they don't tolerate the pain of depression very well, and they feel they just must get out of it. Now, such people are more likely to attempt suicide rather than actual kill themselves. They tend to belong to the group of what's called parasuicides or attempted suicides. They take a non-lethal overdose or cut their wrists or make some gesture, which is essentially a method of appealing for help. And certainly they are people in need of help. There are people who are sometimes, the very fact that they have to resort to this method means that they have been rather neglected and deprived, or feel they have been, and very often indeed have been. Now that's at one end of a scale, what we call reactive depression. people overreacting to circumstances and situations. Now, at the other end of the scale, you can get very mature, stable, successful, often driving, dynamic people who, it would be said of them, he or she's the last person I'd ever expect to get nerves, who in quite out of character fashion begin to wake up early in the morning, feel gloomy and disinclined to face the day. They find that instead of being decisive, they put things on the long finger, they procrastinate, they find it hard to concentrate, they can't enjoy a joke, even good news doesn't lift their heart. They find that they're looking at the dark side of whatever situation is in front of them. Now, this is a very definite kind of illness to which only some people are predisposed, and some people are quite heavily predisposed to it. And it may come on in response to stress, either psychological or physical. For example, many women get it after childbirth, or many people get it in midlife. Many adolescents go through a phase of this kind. Now, it's, medically speaking, tremendously important to be aware of the possibility of this kind of depression, because untreated, it's very painful and dangerous, because it may lead to suicide.
I used to go out a lot, and I didn't want to go. I didn't want to talk to anyone about my, you know, even my mother, my sisters. I didn't want to speak to anyone about her. I was just bottling her up. And I'd sit and I'd brood, and I wouldn't do nothing in the house. I wouldn't even go as far as say no. I didn't even cook for the kids. You know, I just let everything pile up. And I just sit and brood all the time and thinking.
And did you ever think of trying it again?
I did, yes. About 10 weeks ago, I did. Reese, before I left home, I did thought of it. And I go out that night. If I hadn't gotten out, I think I would have. But I go out in time. You know, so, but since, you know, I've been away now, I haven't thought of it, thank God. I tell you, sometimes it does get on top of me, if things get on top of me, you know, with the children and all, I'd say you'd be better off dead. But I've never actually sat down and said, right, I'm going to do myself in now. But I've often, you know, said, oh, I'll take an overdose, I'll do this, I'll do that. But I don't think I will, I don't think now it's worth it, you know.
Well, after you tried to do yourself in the first time, were you glad it didn't happen then?
I was glad the next day, yeah. I was really glad it
didn't. But at the time you didn't care?
I didn't care two hoots whether I was dead or not. I was just that fed up with everything. I was so depressed over, in a matter of 9 weeks, I was suffering really bad depression that I just didn't care. You know, I really thought that the aspirin would have done it. I mean, 100, you know, but they didn't, like, you know.
Is there any kind of treatment for depression that would prevent a person from attempting suicide?
Yes, I think there is, although one has to be somewhat cautious here, because what evaluative studies there have been of intervention in this area have not indicated that intervention has always been as successful as one would have liked. For example, many people who kill themselves have in fact been attending doctors, even psychiatrists, and have seen them very shortly before they killed themselves, indicating that the psychiatrist or doctor, whoever it was not able to take effective preventive action. On the other hand, of course, there are people who might have killed themselves had they not been along to see the doctor or the psychiatrist or whoever else. And of course, you don't hear about these cases because they don't figure in the statistics. So it's difficult to give any authoritative view about the ones who are seen by psychiatrists and doctors and who don't kill themselves. It would seem, though, prima facie, and on theoretical grounds, that prevention, by which I mean effective treatment of depression, must have some benefit in these cases.
Are there any particular kinds of people who would commit suicide? Is there any age group or profession?
In general, it has been the case that, as I said at the beginning, that elderly males are more likely to figure among the suicide statistics than other types of people. But recent trends throughout Europe have indicated an increasing propensity on the part of young people to kill themselves, although numerically they may still be only a small number of the overall suicides. Yet the risk does seem to be increasing considerably for people aged under 25, for example.
Would there be any particular reason for that?
Well, here you've got to speculate. There aren't no hard facts, after all. But one might say that young people today have a greater expectation of what the world should be giving them, what they should get out of it, than young people, say, half a century ago. And that when their expectations are not fulfilled, as so often the case, they're more likely to be frustrated, less content to put up with the frustration, and to act impulsively, perhaps, in a self-destructive fashion.
Is there any particular reason that suicide has increased so much in Ireland in the last decade or so?
That's a difficult question, and I wouldn't like to be in any sense categorical about it. I would make two points, though. Firstly, these are short-run data. They refer to 10 years, and 10 years is a relatively short time in terms of suicide trends, point number one. Point number two, the numbers we're dealing with in Ireland are quite small. I think the actual increase was from somewhere in the 70s to over 170, that sort of thing. And random variation in when you're dealing with numbers as small as that is important and may just reflect a chance change from year to year. But having said that, I think it is inescapable that the increase has been somewhere between two and three times, and that is of some moment. As to why it should be, I've said to you that an increasing number of young people are killing themselves, and this was clear too in the Irish figures. Although the increase was seen at all ages, but it was more pronounced among the young, who therefore are making more than their contribution to the overall increase.
But even if the figures for suicide are on the increase, Professor Moore is very optimistic about the treatment of depression and its tendencies.
If you like to take the two different kinds of depression, the kind that is overreacting to situations, they need psychological help and support and understanding, and either from a doctor, from a psychiatrist, or from some of the helping agencies such as the Samaritans, who perform a very valuable function in listening to these people and allowing them to ventilate their worries and woes and offer a sympathetic ear. And for this group, they need that kind of psychological help and support, and perhaps education in dealing with their problems in a more mature way than by seeking to end it all. Now, at the other end of the scale, the melancholic type of depression, no amount of comfort and consolation and sympathy will really cure them. Certainly not a holiday or a piece of good news. What they need is a specific treatment. And thank goodness we now have what we call chemotherapy. These are antidepressant chemicals which don't cure them as much as provide an antidote which relieves their symptoms, and they can go on taking them safely until the cycle of depression ends. Because remember, even before we had any treatment, the natural history of this kind of depression was to run through a cycle of weeks or months or occasionally years and then get better. Now the drugs act as a kind of chemical splint that gives the patient emotional control and enables them to function at the work and perhaps not at their very best level, but at a reasonably good level until it ends.
What kind of factor would make the cycle come to an end?
We don't understand why it comes on or why it ends. This is something that my own belief is the answer will come not from a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but from a white-coated laboratory worker, probably a biochemist. That's because these things can come in relation to these kinds of stress. I've mentioned childbirth in middle age and so on, but they can come out of a clear blue sky. The other treatment, by the way, which is an extremely valuable treatment in severe depression, and one which has the misfortune to have aroused a lot of fear and apprehension, is electrical treatment, what we call electroplexy, and which is quite wrongly called shock treatment. This is, the more severely depressed patient is, the more dramatically it acts. And it is a really kind, benevolent thing to do, to give this treatment to a patient who is severely melancholic. And the outlook, the relief it gives is quite dramatic as anything in medicine. You may say, why are people afraid of it? Well, one reason is, I think, because it's so good in the right case that it tends to be used too much in patients who are not suitable for it. For example, the original group I talked about, these people who were overreacting to stress and who were perhaps very anxious and somewhat immature, it doesn't help them at all. It only helps the people at the other end of the scale who've got this depressive illness and whose personalities are mature and stable when they're well. And for them, it can be magic.
I felt I didn't want to live, as I explained before. I had no interest in myself. I had no interest in the children. I had no interest in the home. I had no interest whatsoever in the outside world. I just felt that when I was in the room behind them four walls, that was my home, you know, my room. And I didn't even want to go to the bedroom. I often slept out in the living room, you know. And I was on tablets, but I didn't find they helped me altogether that good. You know, I was on a few, I won't mention the names, but I was on quite a few tablets, you know, four different tablets, you know, four times a day. And they didn't help me at all. But the doctors maintained that you have to help yourself as well, which I found I wasn't helping myself. You know, I wasn't doing anything to help myself. I was brooding too much.
Well, you didn't improve then until you went away from the house.
When I left the house, I have improved tremendously. And I think if I was to go back to, you know, back to the house tomorrow, I'd start again. Now, it wasn't the house, or I wouldn't say it was the children, but it was just, you know, my husband drinking and causing trouble, and he never walks or anything, you know. That really had me bad on it, had me very affected, you know. But, you know, it's a very hard thing to explain. Now, as I said, I went to a top psychiatrist, and I could say, I sat with him for 4 hours, and I told him everything. And he says to me, how do you feel after telling me all about this? I says, I feel okay now, I'm here with you. I says, but when I go home, I says, I won't feel any better. I says, I'm after getting it all off me, out of my system, telling you exactly. I says, you're giving me pills. I says, but I'll go home and I'll just feel the same way again. I said, and tonight I'll be depressed more than I was when I come into you. And he'd say to me, you know, social work, say, you're going to do the work now, you're going to look after the kids. And I'd say, yeah. But I found I couldn't. When I went to do it, I just couldn't. My mind wasn't allowing me. I just say, oh, you know, blow. I say, why bother? I was just letting everything pile up in me. You know, I was letting myself, and I didn't want to open the door to callers. I didn't want anyone coming in to talk to me. I just wanted to be on my own.
In Ireland, being very much a religious kind of country, suicide was always taboo. Has that changed in any way?
I think that it probably has. And again, I'm speaking impressionistically. But I still think that people have certain attitudes towards suicides, and perhaps the families or relatives of people who commit suicide, which are condemnatory. I think that probably still exists, and of course will take a long time to die out, but I think it is dying out. For instance, in the United Kingdom, sometime in the early 60s, attempted suicide ceased to be an offence, a criminal offence, that is, and it still is in this country. Obviously, it would be desirable that it be removed from the statute book as an offence. But it shows perhaps a slowness on our part to change attitudes.
Now, was it formerly true that maybe the same amount of people committed suicide, but coroners were kind in reports and that thinking of families and didn't bring in a suicide or a verdict of suicide?
Yes, figures, international figures, based on the results of coroners' inquiries in those countries where the coroner system operates, such as our own and the United Kingdom, or not the United Kingdom, England and Wales, because Scotland is a different system, will always tend to underestimate the real incidence of suicide, simply because the coroner's function is a legal one, and his adjudication is entirely within the legal context. He therefore is defining death as a legal entity and must be moved by legal considerations. And this means, in effect, that he must have pretty definite evidence that the deceased intended that he die through the act which he initiated. And obviously, if there isn't any unequivocal evidence of intent, then the coroner must hedge his bets and not return a suicide verdict. And in fact, in England, there have been a number of recent cases where aggrieved relatives who felt that the deceased had not killed himself, and in whose case a suicide verdict was brought in by a coroner, appealed to higher courts, and higher courts have set aside the coroner's verdict. Now, that clearly means that coroners must be very circumspect before they name a dead suicide, and in fact they want very high evidence of intent, such as a suicide note, for example, which would indicate clearly that the deceased did want to kill himself and did so. Whereas a medical person, or anyone else for that matter, a lay person, looking at the evidence, would say that on the basis of probabilities, this person killed himself. And therefore, of course, the sets of figures deriving from both sources would be quite different. Therefore, in short, coroner's verdicts do underestimate suicide for legal reasons, not because of anything that that the community itself may feel in its attitude towards suicide.
Feeling lonely, depressed, suicidal. Help and understanding is only a phone call away. So reads the ad of the Samaritans, that voluntary body that operates in Dublin, Cork, Limerick, Waterford and Galway.
And the main function, I think, of the Samaritans is to befriend the lonely, depressed, suicidal people who ring us up. In other words, you know, we kind of offer support, friendship, when the people are going through a crisis period.
When people ring you up, are they usually desperate?
Not all the time, like, you know, I mean, when they ring, that it's not always a crisis situation when they ring us. They might be just lonely. They might be just worried about a certain thing that's troubling them. Or they might be going through a crisis. You know, the three things, you know. So therefore, you know, it's very hard to say when they ring. If they ring during the crisis period, they can be very upset. And we try to talk to them, listen to them, and show them that we care for them. And we offer them the befriending of the Samaritans, you know. If they're just worried about a certain problem, we'll talk to them about what they class as the problem. And then we offer them support. We offer them follow-up. In other words, we kind of offer to kind of contact them if they feel lonely. And that's the main reason the Samaritans are here, to befriend people who are going through a crisis situation, you know.
Do people sometimes ring you then, and they tell you they're just about to do away with themselves?
They do at certain times, yes. And then we kind of we talk, listen to what they have to say, and we try to be as calm as possible. I mean, they don't want to ring a person up and find that they're getting as upset as they are, you know. So you have to be very, very calm, accept them, and hope that they'll allow you to go out to them if necessary and talk through the problem with them, what got them to the stage like of actually committing suicide. Hmm? And most times people will let you go out to them. You know? But if they don't let you go out, I must say that it could get to a stage that we offer to go out and they reject our offer.
Now, overall, then, what are the usual kind of problems they have when they contact you?
I think the major problem would be marital problems, which are the higher. And after that, I'd say, would be loneliness, sexual, if you want to call it deviancy, but homosexuality, depression. But I think marital is the top of the list, I'd say, for.
Would they be husbands now or wives, mostly?
I'd say the major would be... I think women are a higher number callers, but men also. But I think the women are more easy. They find it easier to ring rather than men. Like, you know? Although men do come on with marital problems, like, you know. But a woman will come on, I think, a little faster than a man will. She's inclined to talk more freely. And she's inclined to look for help easier, I think. A man is inclined to try and solve his own problems, like, you know, and doesn't think he needs anyone to listen to him.
When I was separated from my husband and I was looking after kids by myself, and I thought it was, you know, a very hard job to look after children by myself. And then I moved away from where I was living, and I got more depressed because I had my children with me, only one. And I was going to the doctor and I got tablets and they didn't help at all. And he said that I'd have, you know, to get myself out of depression myself if the tablets didn't work. So I knocked off the tablets and I went on sleeping tablets, and I take them in the night time. I often took maybe, you know, more than I should. And the next day the depression would come back again. So I'm trying to, you know, work myself out of it now.
But did it all happen because you were gone from the husband? When were you all right before that?
I was, yeah. Until, you know, my marriage started breaking up. It was 6 years ago. And I had depression now for about 4 years. And that's about it.
And did you feel then you couldn't cope with things?
Oh, I did, yeah. I thought that, you know, the whole world was tumbling in top of me. And I just, you know, just gave up. And then again, I got help from, you know, the social workers and said it's no good, you know, lying back and taking it all, to get up and do something about it. So I did.
And I don't... If you hadn't people now like the social workers to help you, what would have happened?
I think I'd have gone to pieces. I really would, because... You know, I really used to get bad. And they, you know, they helped me out a lot.
Did you ever think now of doing yourself in and getting away from it all?
In the night time, when I, you know, when I'm there by myself, I often say, you know, is it worth it, you know, going through it? And would I be better off dead? And then I think about it for a while and say, well, I'd be no good to anybody if I was dead. And it's mostly the loneliness now, you know, that I get depressed over.
Is there anything now you can do about it?
Well, in the summer, you know, the weather gets better. I'd like to go around and see all the museums, things like that. But at the moment there isn't, you know. But I don't feel as bad as, you know, as I was, we'll say, about 4 months ago. I was really, you know, really depressed, and you know, I tried to get myself out of it. I used to get fits of crying for hours and hours, you know, even on the buses I start crying. But I'm not as bad as I was. It's only mostly now in the night time that, you know, I get depressed when, we'll say, when it gets dark and I'm sitting there, you know.
Well, is it long now since you separated from the husband?
A year away, but I was away from then again. 4 years ago, for 2 years. So I, you know, I married, was it 9 years, and I lived with him about five.
Yeah. And did it work all right at one time?
Yeah, you know, then he started to drink a lot and gamble and started going back with his old friends. And, you know, I just couldn't take it. He's come in then and beat me up. You know, I just asked him not to go out with his friends, stay in some nights, you know, in the week with the children. And he wouldn't listen. He just... would say, kick me on the ground and, you know, walk past me, go out, come in any time he liked. He often stayed away for weekends, never came home. And I have a, you know, retarded little girl, and he had never, you know, much time for her because she was retarded. And he just used to go out and get drunk.
And did you ever think now you'd get any comfort out of drink?
Me?
Yeah.
No, not really.
Yeah.
Because it's like this, I think if you have a problem and you go drinking, you know, the next morning you wake up, you still have the problem and you have a hangover as well. I've tried that as well. I know the next day the problem will still be there.
People sometimes wonder if there's any connection between suicidal attempts and drink problems. Professor Moore.
Well, indeed, I'm very glad you mentioned that because you reminded me of probably what may be the most important explanation of why the suicide rate has gone up. It's a very well-known fact that suicide is a complication of alcoholism and even of heavy drinking. And in fact, I think it's true to say that most suicidal attempts and most successful suicides are carried out under the influence of alcohol or drugs, particularly alcohol. So that in this country, as in all the Western world, the consumption of alcohol is rising steeply. More and more people are drinking more alcohol at a younger age, and a wider spectrum of the community is drinking heavily. And this undoubtedly would be a significant factor, to my mind, in increasing the suicide rate. Because alcohol is a depressant, which it may give a temporary illusion of well-being at the very early stages of a drinking session, but it is pharmacologically and physiologically a depressant. And when the person goes on drinking, they will get more depressed. And during the withdrawal phase, when in the early hours of the morning, a depressed person would be at a very much graver risk of actually killing themselves.
People sometimes attempt suicide and they don't want to go the whole way. How do they know just how far to go? Dr. Walsh?
Well, very often I think they don't. They behave very impulsively and take a mouthful of tablets or a box full of tablets and so forth. The tablets are, generally speaking, now less dangerous and less lethal than they were in the past, although some are still dangerous. And you've got to swallow a great number of them before you succeed in killing yourself. That's one point. But it is also true, I expect, that many people who take overdoses know pretty well that the amount of tablets they're taking is not sufficient to do them any harm, and then they take them. Quite often the purpose, if there is a consciously articulated purpose, and often there isn't, because, as I said, people do it impulsively and haven't the time to think, is not to kill oneself, but to get some sort of response from the environment in relation to the particular difficulty or problem which is causing one anxiety or depression or whatever at that point in time. And of course, this generally happens because if you take an overdose, your relatives know about it. They see it as a life-endangering procedure, and then naturally they're going to give you attention. Furthermore, other agencies are brought into your orbit of functioning and your area of distress. Yeah, because if you get taken off to a hospital, you'll be seen by a casualty officer, a doctor. You may well be referred to a social worker to deal with your social problems. If, for instance, it's trouble with your husband who's drinking too much, or if it's having to live in a mobile home and not getting priority in the corporation housing list, for instance. And then you may be seen by a psychiatrist and so on. So in this way, there is a purpose, and a useful purpose, to be served by a suicide attempt, that you enlarge the orbit of your difficulties and bring in other helping agencies other than your immediate family or relatives to your problem. So I wouldn't dismiss attempted suicides as being wholly, wholly malicious and wholly wasteful. Sometimes they do serve a purpose to the person who has attempted suicide.
Thank you.
I used to always think, you know, psychiatrists were head shrinkers to put you on a couch and want to know everything in your personal life, but I don't think it's so. I went to one here, you know, and I found him very, very good. That, you know, that he did listen to what I had to say. When I came here first, I thought nobody would listen. But when I went to him, I found him very, very good. And, you know, I felt that he cared, you know. And it was then really that I sort of picked myself up. I cut off the tablets and, you know, I got better.
But when you're depressed like that and you feel that there's no place for you, you're not wanted any place, what do you feel then is the best thing that could happen to you that could take you out of that?
What I usually do is try and think ahead, of better things. I mean, you know, it can't be any worse than it is now. It must get better sometime. So that's why I really think about it when I really get down. I say, well, God is good. Maybe next month things will be better. Well, that's when I really get down, you know. That's what I think about.
Well, do you find it then lonely here in the city?
Oh, I do, yeah. I do. That's the worst part of it all. You know, it's then that I really, you know, get lonely and depressed. I don't know anybody here. Nobody at all. I just sit in the room in the night. I read a lot of detectives. You know, pestering, you know, the hours in the night. I just sit up and I haven't got a television yet. But I read a lot of books, you know, to pass time away. It takes me hours to go to sleep. I sleep about 2 o'clock. Maybe sometimes I often stay awake until 5:30. It's then that I really get, you know, really lonely. You know, even for my family. If I was, you know, at home, it would be different. I had my friends and my own family I could go down to, you know. I wouldn't go back there. I just, you know, rather live my past there. That's why I came up here, you know, to start a different life altogether. I want to forget about all that.